Good afternoon. Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and welcome today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club. I am, as you can see, Joel Brinkley, and I won't reprise my own introduction. I have other attributes, some of them positive, some of them not. I'll be your chair for today's program, The Rise of Turkey. We are also want to welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished panel. Bonnie Joy Kaslan is Honorary Consul General for the Turkish Republic here in the Bay Area. She has served the Turkish American community since 1978. It's a long time. She's president of the Turkish American Association of California from 1983 to 1985. She served on the board of directors of the Assembly of Turkish American Associations as Western Region Vice President for 2 years. In 1982, she was named Woman of the Year for the Turkish American community in California. Steve West was a Fulbright Scholar to Turkey and has served as Professor of Turkish Language and Cultural History at UCLA and the University of Pennsylvania. He's also served as the Olympic Envoy for Turkey and Oman at the 1984 Olympics. He has lived in Turkey, Cyprus, Lebanon, Austria, and has traveled to 35 countries. Anastasia Ashman, a Berkeley native, lived in Turkey for 8 years and is the author-editor of Expat Harem, the stories of seven women from seven nations in five continents about their lives in modern Turkey. And she now runs an interesting website called globalniche.net, which she describes as, quote, a new work-life initiative for cultural creatives and mobile progressives. Now, I'm going to speak to you for just a few minutes about Turkey from a journalist's perspective, and then each of our panelists will speak to you, and then I will start the questioning and perhaps discussion among the panelists, and then we'll open the floor to questions from you, and you can send up cards with whatever you'd like to ask. I write about Turkey occasionally, and I have worked there on assignment for my previous employer, the New York Times, and it's a country I admire in many ways, but it's also a country that has a number of troubling aspects. I guess you could say that about any country, including our own, of course. Economically, the nation seems to be going well. Lots of new housing is being built to solve a housing problem. The economy is growing, albeit slowly, like our own. Inflation is way down. In 1999, the inflation rate in Turkey stood at 65%. That's what you call hyperinflation. Today, it's roughly 8%. Still high, but obviously much, much better. And the government has worked hard and successfully to lower a dangerous budget deficit, which now stands at 42% of GDP, about 30% lower than our own. That's all good news. But some of Turkey's less attractive characteristics are troubling to people in my profession particularly. For a while last year, Turkey had more journalists in prison than any other nation on earth, more than North Korea, more than Iran, more than China, more than Eritrea, which has the least free press in the world. The situation seems to have improved a bit in the last 6 months, but not enough in my view. Now the Committee to Protect Journalists ranks Turkey the sixth worst, tied with Syria for the most journalists in jail. Frank Rettenberg, a retired Foreign Service officer who served as U.S. Consul in Turkey, spoke in the Bay Area last month, and he said 72 journalists are now in jail, and 36 of them have been indicted, charged with encouraging and plotting a coup. These journalists, along with hundreds of others in and out of government and the military, have run afoul of two Turkish controversies. One is the Kurdish minority's fight for independence, an ongoing issue. The other is the government's dogged pursuit of the so-called Ergenekon affair, a government allegation that the military wants to stage another coup. Over the years, there have been several. So it's not, you know, not a spurious idea, at least. This all began in 2007 when police found a cache of hand grenades in the attic of a slum home. From that and other statements that were found, and the government spun the story of an active plot. In pursuit of that, so far, the Erdogan government has jailed more than 300 people, including more than 200 active or retired military officers, among them Ilker Basbug, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the former chief of the Army's general staff, who was arrested last month. This purge goes on even now, 5 years after this plot tale was spun, even though we've seen no particular striking evidence of a coup or other malicious anti-government behavior of this sort. As for the journalists, some of them remain in jail without charge, along with hundreds of others. And Dinja Mijaktovic, who's press freedom officer for the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe, said in a report that was published last year that national security should not be used as a ground to curb media freedom. This was out of a report the OSCE published on Turkey's assault on the press. And she and others chastised Turkey for arresting reporters for simply reporting on this Ergenekon plot. The report said, quote, writing about sensitive issues, including issues of terrorism or anti-government activities, is often considered by the government as supporting those issues. Imagine how many journalists would be in jail here, including myself, for that sort of view. In my opinion, you cannot have a free country without a free press. If the government is afraid of a coup, then it's the job of the news media to serve as the watchdog, not the puppy dog. It's definitely the news media's job to look into coup allegations and see what's there. And without that, I don't know where Turkey is going, but I'll leave that to our panelists to tell you. First, I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program for the Commonwealth Club of California, and that you are listening to The Rise of Turkey with Bonnie Caslin, Anastasia Ashman, and Dr. Stephen West. I'm Joel Brinkley, the moderator. We have a large number of questions, I suspect, so let's begin. Let's start with Bonnie. She's going to talk to us for a few minutes. No, I'm sorry, we changed the order. Steve's going to talk to us for a few minutes, and then we'll go down the table here.
Okay. Shall I talk from there? Or from here?
From your seat.
Okay. Good afternoon. It's great to see everybody making this effort to be here today. I'm rather struck by that, I must tell you. I'm an American, so I'm from Indiana. I'm a Hoosier. I'm not Turkish. I probably am about 80% German and about 20% English in my heritage. So I don't have any direct connection to the Turks at all, except that I've devoted quite a bit of my professional life to the Turks. And I'd like to talk with you a little bit about why that is the case. I first came to Istanbul in 1959. Now, that's some years ago. I was just a kid, and I was traveling with my parents. We went by ship from Athens to Istanbul. And I haven't been quite the same since. There was something about just coming up the Bosphorus into the city that struck me. A lot of things you'll see here in San Francisco are a bit similar. The city on the hill looking over the water. Some of you have been there. If you haven't been to Turkey, please promise me that you go as soon as you can. It's a fascinating place to visit. What I'd like to talk with you about is a little bit of the cultural heritage of the Turks, and I'm going to go to some, very quickly, to some ancient times and bring us up right up to the modern date in terms of culture, that is to say values. In my opinion, when we talk about politics or the military movements, it's already too late. The politics is, that's after the fact. What we need to do is to get down to the coffee shop, And, of course, if you haven't had Turkish coffee, you must try that. It is very strong and delicious. Sit down and talk with each other and begin to get to know each other. That's our biggest problem on this earth, in my opinion. We really don't know each other. And it's not that hard because in my heritage, I come from a Christian heritage. I grew up with the notion of the terrible Turk. That was actually in our church liturgy. I remember that. And dear God, deliver us from the terrible Turk. So I've always been curious about that. Where is this Turk? In Chicago? You know, I wasn't quite sure where he was located, but I knew he was terrible. So I've always been drawn to terrible people. So I thought, well, I'd like to get to know these folks a little better. I took my third year of college in Beirut, Lebanon. Then I lived in a village in Cyprus for 2 years, worked a lot like Peace Corps. It was a Greek half of a mixed village, half Greek and half Turkish. And then I've lived in Istanbul. And as Joel mentioned, I put my blinders on with the Turkish language and the cultural history of the Turks. And I taught Turkish for 12 years. How good is my Turkish? Well, I'll never be a native. But I know quite a bit of grammar, especially. So if you have some questions about Turkish grammar, ask me. Where do the Turks come from? And this is part of the theme that I'd like to discuss with you. The Turks have a lot in common with us in this country. What does that mean? Well, they're fish out of water. We're fish out of water. Many of us have European heritage, and we're basically the dropouts from Europe. We're the ones, the bad boys and girls, that came to the USA for various reasons, under a lot of hardship, and we have carved out a cultural system that is receptive to new ideas. The Turks have done the same thing. If you look at their context, where are they from? They're from Western Mongolia. They're called Altaic people. The Altai Mountains run on the western edge of Mongolia. That's where their original home is. And they are related, both linguistically and, I'm convinced, culturally, to the Japanese and the Koreans as well. And there's a theme here that I'd like to have you consider for just a few minutes. And that's the issue of cultural receptivity. The Turks have not been in the Middle East that long. It's only 1,000 years. Now, I mean, that may sound like a while, but compared to Arabs and Jews and Iranians, it's really almost a blink of an eye. So they were outsiders when they first came, a little over 1,000 years ago. How did they come in? They came in as Muslims. They already were Muslims. In a sense, they saved Islam. And they did it with two things: a military capability that was not there at that time, and a social organization that they brought with them from Central Asia. They made it successful. We call that the Ottoman Empire. Now, that's 600 years of Turks, of a vast stretch of land, as you know, in the Middle East, all across North Africa, under the control of Turks. So the Turks went then from Baghdad to what we called, what the Greeks called Anatolia, and Anatolia became Turkey. Many people there were Indo-European, many were Greek Christians, and if your name was Stelios, and you were a Christian 1,000 years ago, then you became Ahmet. And you were a Muslim, the same body. And I'm not saying that that's just across the board, but essentially the issue of race means nothing here at all. If you were to look at pure Turks, you would be looking at someone closely related physically to the Mongols and the Kazakhs and the Kyrgyz, who are their cousins of Central Asia. So the Turks had nothing to lose by learning new things. That's how they approached Islam 1,000 years ago. That's how Mustafa Kemal Atatürk approached Europe and modernization a little less than 100 years ago. Mustafa Kemal was actually a blonde, blue-eyed man. His mother was Albanian. So you can see that race really is not an issue here. What did he do? He, in a sense, turned the country upside down overnight. Ottoman went to Turkish. The Turks use the same letters that we do now. Ottoman is essentially Turkish in the Arabic letters for 600 years. He gave tremendous freedom to women almost 100 years ago. He abolished the fez. He really rearranged the entire value system. And if you go to Turkey, you will see denomination of money will have Mustafa Kemal on it. This, if we're in Turkey, it would be a big picture of Mustafa Kemal up here on the wall. I don't worship Mustafa Kemal. That's not the point. But what I do observe is that the Turks are very much open to change, and that's what they're doing right now. If we talk about the rise of Turkey today, one of the things that I'm concerned about with us in our heritage is that that's going to bring up the notion of the terrible Turk. Oh, my God, the Turks are on the rise again. You know, we better watch out. They're going to get us. That goes back to our heritage in the Middle Ages. That doesn't belong now. That's not where it's at. That's not the new game in town. The Turks want to participate in this modern, global culture and economy that is going on right now, which our own nation is very much a leader of. They want to participate. I'm making a generalization, I know this, but that's all right. 99% of the Turks are Muslim, and I know quite a few of them. Is that everyone? Of course not. Thank you, Celia. They're moving forward. You find them throughout Central Asia with their cousins, the Kazakhs, the Kyrgyz, the Uzbek, the Azerbaijanis. They're leaders in business. That's an ancient heritage. That goes back before they were even Turks. So commerce Turkey will become, as I understand it, within the next short period of time, a few years, will become one of the top 10 economies of the earth. That's quite remarkable. And they're Muslims. We of Judeo-Christian background can make friends with Muslims, especially if it's Islam light, which is what the Turks do in general. On the other hand, there is fundamentalism there, certainly. That's true in this country. Why? Why is there so much fundamentalism all around the world? It's because I think we're, in a cultural sense, we're too close to each other too early. We're in our faces before we're ready culturally. And so here they are. The Turks are right in our faces, and the Chinese and everybody else. And, oh, my God, it's not just that there are people out there, at a distance. We're interacting with them, and that's a little scary for some people, and maybe for all of us to some degree. But put your seatbelt on and stay with the journey, because it's a lot of fun. The Turks are not, I'm convinced, we will not be hearing about the mullahs of Ankara. I don't think that's realistic at all. The Turks have too much to lose. They know that. They haven't learned this material for 1,000 years for nothing. So anyhow, before I go on, thank you very much for your attention, and I'll turn it over to someone else.
Thank you, Stephen. Anastasia.
I pronounce that Anastasia.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I wrote it down and I forgot. I sorry.
Actually, we were talking earlier, the panel, about what we were going to talk about, and I said, I think actually the things that I want to talk about all end up converging on the same thing, and it's actually about the limbo state of Turkey. Turkey is a limbo state, and I think that anything that we talk about here today, we have to consider it in that light, because there is no solid ground there, actually. First, I'll tell you how I came to be associated with Turkey, and hopefully you'll start to see in my story what I mean by that limbo state. I studied archaeology, classical Greek, Roman, and Near Eastern archaeology in college, so I was already familiar with the region and already interested in certain things there. But our studies sort of ended when Constantine founded New Rome in Constantinople, and that was sort of the end of what we knew about the place. So once I got there, actually, I started digging deeper. And but the reason that I got there was because I met a Turkish man who I married in 2001. And we got married in Istanbul. And we got married in an Ottoman palace in Ortaköy. It was the palace of an 18th century daughter of a sultan. And it was a very lovely storybook kind of evening. And it was also, there was something very easy about the impact of the place. There was something very magical about the fact that there could be all of this history and beauty, but also that people were using these monuments, and these monuments were set against these modern backdrops of the Bosphorus Bridge and boats going by, like just commuter boats going by the dock of the palace. And then right next door to that is like a little walking village that has been sort of rehabilitated to be sort of a Turkish tourist attraction called Ortaköy. And so the place was already very charming to me, but I really didn't know if the fairy tale would continue when I ended up moving there about 18 months later. So we moved to Turkey and moved into a neighborhood that is filled with foreign correspondents and other foreigners of different kinds, and has been. I guess it was settled in like the 13th century, so it had a lot of history of its own. But it was on the banks of the Bosphorus, on the Beyoğlu side. So it was what they call the new town. But of course, 13th century is not that new. But anyway, living there among these foreign correspondents was interesting because a lot of them, of course, were people who had been there for a long time, and they had gotten really sort of nativized in their interest. The more that you know about Turkey, I think it's a natural progression that you take. You start getting a little bit more, your life is interwoven with the Turks that you met, and you start falling in love with different aspects of it. And on a lot of them said, you know, we actually get cycled out of a place once we do go native. You know, our editors don't want to hear what we have to say once we fall in love with a place, which is, I think, a really bad trend, because I think people who are in love with a place can tell you things that people who are not in love with a place don't even see. And so that became an issue when I put together a book called Tales from the Expat Harem, which is actually 32 women about their lives in modern Turkey. So it's an anthology. The women wrote their own tales. I'm one of the editors. There were two of us editing the book. And when we started pitching the story of this book to foreign correspondents once it was published, and I will go back and tell you a little bit about the experience of publishing it, because that was, I think, illuminating about how Americans view Turkey. But once we sent it around to these foreign correspondents, some of them, you know, were friends of ours. They said, we would love to, you know, cover this book. But and by the way, we were getting it published by a Turkish publisher, so it was Turkish news. They said, actually, our editors do not want to hear about positive stories about Turkey because it doesn't fit the picture, that they have an agenda of their own that they need to address. And when we send them stories that don't fit that picture, they reject it. That's also how news is made, is that it's the preconceived notions of what the story is, and so then you look for evidence of that. And so actually after we published it in Turkey, we sent it to publishing houses in America. And in New York, it went to all the big houses, and a lot of people said, oh, you know, very charming, great idea, but Turkey is too small a topic. And we were like, well, Turkey is the biggest topic we can think of. How could it be too small? And they said, well, you know, why don't you just put, like, the whole Muslim world in there? It's like, look at how big this book is. Like, have the whole Muslim world. And the fact is, the whole Muslim world is very different. And just because we were based in Turkey and we were actually mining our contacts there and our knowledge of the place did not mean that we knew the whole Muslim world and that we had contacts everywhere. And, you know, we would not have been able to do its service. And I remember saying to them, and this was actually one of the people who suggested this, was a house that specializes in anthologies. So they're actually in a position to do what we suggested next, which was, okay, well, let's just start with this one, and then we'll do one for each Muslim nation. We'll do we'll do 20, we'll do 40, however many there are out there. And we could just, you know, go forever with this. And they were like, no, we're not interested. So actually, you know, it's interesting that they want the whole Muslim world all, you know, boiled down, but there is actually no truth in that. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was that, oh, right, that the reason that I think that the expat women had a specific view of Turkey that is actually interesting and unknown is because those expat women existed in this same state of limbo that I feel that Turkey exists in. And that is when we started conceptualizing the book, we said, let's call it Expat Harem. And what we mean by that is that when people come together, they, especially people from maybe similar backgrounds or, you know, people who are all foreigners, they actually can create a cultural refuge together and bring information to each other about how this place operates. And but the other side of that is that it can become a cultural prison, that you start, like, it's like an echo chamber in there. So a lot of people said to us, well, what do you mean by, you know, how could harem be a good thing? And I said, well, actually, you know, of course it's not a good thing. It's both. It's either and it's or and it's both at the same time. It is, you know, in this case, a cultural prison and a cultural refuge. The door swings both ways. And so one of the first people who blurbed our book was Turkish novelist Elif Shafak, and she said, you know, I'm so excited to see this book because it acknowledges this Eastern continuum of female power that is so unknown in the West, that people think that the harem is just a bad thing, just across the board a bad thing, or they think it's some kind of place where orgies take place and, like, this crazy, you know, reprobate behavior, when actually it's where women did gather and where women had a chance to learn from each other. And in the case of the Sultan's harem, it's where people came from all over and had opportunities available to them that were not available anywhere else. They were educated there. They were eventually married off to members of the court. You know, they got actual opportunities to enter society at a much higher level than they would have if they had not been in the harem. And in fact, there were all kinds of cases of Italian families setting their daughters adrift in boats in the Adriatic, hoping that they would be picked up by Ottoman sailors and taken back to Istanbul, because that was opportunity in those days. So, and there were also, of course, you know, I think some of the women in the harem were people who had not only the Sultan's ear, but some of them shadow ruled, like Roxolana, the wife of Suleiman the Magnificent. And I met with a TV4 producer when he came to do some advanced scouting for a television show with Rupert Everett about the adventures of Lord Byron, and he had a lot of questions about what Lord Byron might have been doing when he was in Istanbul. And he said to me, do you think that he could have gained access to the Sultan's harem? And I said, are you kidding me? No. Like, first of all, that's where the Sultan lived, okay? Is he going to, like, get some randy, you know, weirdo clubfoot guy in there? No. No. And if you go into the harem right now, you will see that the most modern rooms of the Topkapı Palace are the mother of the Sultan's apartments, which means that that woman was getting everything that possible that she could be getting at that point. That's what she, I mean, when you look at the fact that they left that palace and moved on to the Dolmabahce, the style of her rooms are almost the same as the Dolmabahce. She was as current as possible. Do you think that you know, these weird gallivanters were, like, being brought in there and it was just a big party? You know, it's just actually, the mind goes wild, really, and the Orientalist mind goes wild. So I'm not sure how much more time I have, but I guess I just wanted to follow up on some things that Joel mentioned. One of them was that press censorship, of course, is on the rise in Turkey. But it's also ironic that Turkey is a place where I found my voice and also was able to give voice to a lot of other people who are not traditionally heard from. Also that, let's see, when we were looking for comparable titles to this book, so many of the books available were all very heavy duty, very, very dark, very, like, you know, things, heartbreaking stuff. And there were almost no views of everyday life or the average people, and very few that captured the character of the Turks. And when we published the book, we had so many bizarre objections to it, even though it was both a critical and popular success. We were called racist. There was a complaint lodged with the U.S. Consul General. Why did those girls do this thing? You know, just crazy stuff. But also, we were operating with some privilege as foreigners in Turkey, and that means that we were existing outside the norms, which is part of that limbo state, that it can accommodate that. And actually, someone pointed out to us that only American women could have gotten a Turkish publisher to print the Kurdish word for mother, which we did. And it's repeatedly in one story here. It's Yade. And One other thing about Turkey being sort of a model for the Muslim world, first of all, as we saw, it's both, you know, some people hope that it is, but of course it never can be because no other place is comparable to Turkey. So I really don't think that it can be a model for anybody. That someone mentioned the Arab Spring. Well, I guess that's the topic here today. And I just wanted to say that I think that Turkey actually has a lot to learn from larger lessons elsewhere, such as that dictatorship is worth fighting. I think that when on May 15th there was a very massive demonstration in Istanbul against internet censorship and took place in smaller numbers around the country, what I saw there, and I did go that day and I did take part, and I marched for an hour, and when I left the demonstration, it continued on for 3 hours more, and that was, you know, chock-a-block, the whole length of Istiklal, which is a mile long. So it, to me, that must have been in the hundreds of thousands of people, because we actually did calculate once that a million people walk down Istiklal every day, and never in that amount of density. But, of course, for maybe 3 or 4 hours this occurred. But to me, it was very obvious that they were taking their cue from the uprisings that they had been witnessing, because they saw other people really dying for the rights that they were already enjoying and that they were now seeing possibly being taken away from them by this internet censorship bill. And also that I think secularism is worth fighting for, and that Turks actually know that probably more than other people, especially more than other people in the region, although I think that they got shown by these people who were really, really in the trenches in Yemen and Bahrain and Egypt. These were extreme lessons to witness. So I think that we're going to see more pushback, and I think that we already are seeing it, like with there's a Kanal D news anchor. His name is Mehmet Ali Barand. Just last month, he published in Hurriyet Daily News a pretty strongly worded op-ed about the lying liars in the politicians. Okay. And basically that this is the first time that he was saying it, and the man is a news veteran. I will pass it on to Bonnie. I obviously could go on forever. Okay. Thank you.
Well, we would be delighted to have you go on forever, but we have...
I'm done.
Thank you, Anastasia. And now we'll hear from Bonnie, our consul in the area.
Oh, Bonnie Joy, that's who I am. First of all, again, welcome everybody. It's wonderful to see so many people here at the lunchtime and to see friends from years past. I think those of you who are from my long past with Turkey will remember the days when we couldn't maybe get 25 in a room like this. So this is pretty spectacular. I'm grateful to Celia, the Commonwealth Club, and to Dr. West, to Anastasia, for actually giving a voice to something that, and voices to Turks, voices to the Turkish-American community, because my adventure, challenges, and love affair with Turkey began July 15th, 1978, here in San Francisco, when I married the now late Ömer Atilla Koca Aslan, Robert College graduate, and I happened to think naively then that all Turks were like Robert College graduates. And then I realized that the Turks are so, as you picked up here, so diverse, dynamic, open, at the same time they're enthusiastic about life, and yet there's a part of them that will hold back. We say, it could be an ethnic group, and say, 10 Greeks come together, and by the way, part of my husband's family didn't speak Turkish, they spoke Greek, and they'll form one association. 10 Turks come together and form 11 associations, which tells you that everybody has an opinion, a passion, a care, and wants it sometimes their way. So that's a great, I think, kudo to the fact that Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, out of the ashes of the Ottoman Empire, was able to put together a country that is so pivotally located called the Modern Republic of Turkey. And when we talk about the backgrounds of who and what the Turks are, where they came from, he wisely also said, recognizing from the background of Attila, Bulgarian Albanian, but from his stepfather, Cherkess. And in fact, Dr. West is right, that when you look at the real Turk, you will see more of the Oriental features. And yet linguistically, there's a similarity. They can eventually understand one another. However, it's not really a melting pot. I think Atatürk wisely said, when he looked at this new nation, happy is he who calls himself a Turk. So that gave ample room for people not born in Turkey to really consider themselves to be Turks. And the past, as I said, since 1978, it has been challenging, adventurous, but my actually career, if you will, began in the midst of terrorism, when scores of Turkish diplomats and their families were being systematically targeted and, if not, assassinated. And so it was when I married my husband, people who used to like me, I thought, suddenly began to shun me. And that's how I began to think, what is going on with these people? Who are these people? They're almost invisible. They have no voice. Because, in fact, the Turks are relatively latecomers as passport holders, of, if you will, of the former Ottoman Empire. They were very few in numbers. And I think even today, if we look across the United States, we'd be lucky if we have 450,000 Turks, Turkish Americans in the United States. And there was no unification. Where we see a rise in the building, development of mosques in Turkey, and perhaps an adherence in varying degrees to Islam, as Steve says, 99% are adherents to Islam, varying degrees. That unifying factor was not in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s in the United States. So it was an ambassador, Dr. Şükrü Elekta, Golden Gloves boxer, who came to Washington. I think he sometimes went to Congress with a baseball bat, if not a redwood tree, to convince them that Cyprus is not off Athens. It's off the coast of Turkey. And so he looked around and realized, why are the Turks not like other ethnic groups, defending, talking, sharing? And it may be, number one, small in numbers, not unified. And another little joke we say is that, well, see, the Turks neither brag about the accomplishments of which they have many to, including that Suleiman the lawgiver is in the halls of Congress. Don't brag, and neither do they muzmuz, which is kind of crybaby complain, about their own rights and tragedies of which there are that exist. So there was no unification, there was no voice as such, and he had this bright idea to unify the Turks under something and encourage them to form something called the Assembly of Turkish American Associations. Made his maiden voyage to the West Coast and got, there were about 500 of us in the audience and spoke completely in Turkish. Well, no wonder nobody understands who you are. This is not going to work. So this saucy young bride flies out of her seat, can't even remember protocol, and says, "Excuse me, sir," and proceeds to talk about lack of dual citizenship, about having the diplomats cater to their, you know, native Turks and not meeting with Turkish Americans who have the right to vote here, who are owning businesses, who can help spread the word, etc. And still in Turkish, she says, "Will this woman's husband please stand up?" And I said, "Oh my, all those images of the terrible, uh-oh, maybe we're going to be excommunicated." And he says, still in Turkish, "My compliments, sir, on your choice of wife." Now, of course, that didn't sit very well. And I thought, what am I, chopped liver? Except he got it. He actually got it. And he was able to go around the country, and from then on, spoke in English, said to the Turks, "You need to come together. We have a history and a culture." And that's when we used to joke, "Yeah, but how are you going to get the word out if you weren't born with the PR gene?" And that was sort of the joke, that the PR, that they didn't have the public relations gene and the element. And that's why I'm so pleased, really, to see Anastasia and Stephen, Dr. West, here to talk about their experiences. And it's not all rosy, but it is an adventure. It is wonderful. It's worth exploring, to where now we have an audience like this who are actually interested, not just in the politics, not just in one tiny little aspect, but in who and what are the Turks. And when I was asked 2 years later, when Ambassador made his voyage back and said, "We'd like to meet with you and our husband in our suite," I'm thinking, "We would like you to be our consul general." In terrorism and assassinations, we had just lost consul general in L.A. Actually, we had two assassinated in 78, I believe, and then 1982. Actually friends of my late husband's. And I remember looking at him, and he's still a formidable man, just recently retired from Parliament, the eldest man in Parliament. And I remember looking at him saying, "Well, sir, does a coffin come with a job?" Because that's, and I said, and of course he was stunned. He was very, very formal. He was not really known for his sense of humor, but he's wonderful. And he said, looked at Murat Sungar, who was second in command, musician, who was sitting there like this. And he looked at me and I said, "Well, let me ask you. Are you asking me because, A, I'm a woman, B, I'm an American, and C, you think I have John Travolta's theme song, Stayin' Alive?" And that was sort of what I think was in their mind. But besides that, I had a big mouth. And I said, I can't be a social butterfly for events. But if you are looking for someone to be an educator, an advocate, and a facilitator between countries and people, Turkey and the U.S., then I can do that. And that's what I've been doing for 26 years. And now I've moved into the arena of moving Turkey from just everyone looking at the politics, looking at old issues, looking at old hatreds, to doing something with the Turkish Cultural Foundation, which was the dream of a young Turkish-American wealthy individual who, when he sold his company, started the Turkish Cultural Foundation and the Turkish Coalition of America, and brought me on board to create. I created the project of bringing American educators to Turkey to see, touch, and feel the whole spectrum. And we recommend books like Tom Brosnahan, like Anastasia's book, to get the feel of people who've lived, the not journalists also, but people who've had their feet on the soil that were just ended up there, and a love affair kept them, and they are able to look at Turkey objectively, to see the warts and still embrace it. And so now, through the Turkish Cultural Foundation and grants that are given to public affairs organizations such as international centers, world affairs councils, we are bringing American educators from all over the United States to Turkey. So the beat goes on. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bonnie. Now, I'm going to ask each of you a question, and then we'll begin to answer questions that you have given us. And there are actually some common themes to your questions, so that's good. Stephen, you were there a while back, and how do you view Turkey as a developing democracy today?
Oh, my. The word democracy itself. Look, I'm troubled by it even in our own country. So it's a Greek concept, and that doesn't make it the enemy of the Turks, not by any means. But I think democracy in general is very hard to maintain, a true democracy anywhere in the world. I don't really think there is an example of a true democracy anywhere. Turkey, as I see it, has what I would call a forced democracy, or it has been ever since Atatürk. The way I see it is this. He died in 1938, but he was, until recently, still the president of Turkey. And so there would be a civilian democracy, you know, one could say, for a period of time, and they'd go off track, and so the military would come in and say, okay, you guys didn't get it, so sit down and sign these 10 points, and we're going to take you back to Atatürk, who's really the president. So this is a very hard question for me to answer. I mean, I feel very strongly about it, but I think it's very hard to maintain, and I'm not sure I'm answering your question really, but it's an ideal of mine. It has been, of course. You know, we talk about it in our country, and we do have, in some ways, I think, more of a democracy now than ever, and the Turks do as well. And I think partly that may have to do with the Arab Spring and the cell phones. People are communicating with each other. That's the beginning of it. In order to have a true democracy, in my opinion, you need a very strong middle class that actually controls decision making. so that I could go on, but that's probably
all right.
Plenty.
Okay. Anastasia, what do you think about this? Is actually something I wanted to ask, and a few people from the audience wanted to ask. How are Turkish women and foreign women treated in Turkey? Are they treated differently, or are they?
Yes and no, because that's the Turkish answer. Yes and no. But also, I think that if you're a woman of a certain age, no matter what your ethnicity or nationality, you're going to be treated more a certain way than you might be elsewhere, such as you're going to get respect. There are certain things that are just culturally, sort of triggered. And so I think that one of the things that I like to tell people when they're visiting Turkey, people who are younger and maybe a little bit naive about traveling abroad, I always say, act like you're the Queen of Sheba, and you will be treated beautifully, because, especially in the tourist areas. Other places, I think that Turkish men are extremely chivalrous, and so women can enjoy that, definitely. But I think that, and of course, Turkish women, I don't think have a problem with foreign women, so I think that they treat them just fine everywhere. But I think that if you're maybe even a light-haired person or a very smiley person, when you are in areas with a lot of people in the tourism trade who are used to travelers, and but maybe from the Southeast, where they actually have a different cultural norm about how women should behave, if you want to not be harassed, because there is that, then you act like a Turkish woman, and that's how she would act. She would walk around. She would not be meeting anyone's eye unless she needs help from them. And they do fall into line. They will behave the way you tell them to behave. So I think that being a woman in Turkey for me was fabulous. So and the Turkish women that I know, I mean, I definitely learned a lot from them about, you know, helping to modulate your behavior so that you are treated the way that you deserve to be treated.
Thank you. So, Bonnie, as Consul General, what kind of issues and problems do you deal with around here in the course of your job?
I would say that it has changed in the past 25, 26 years. In the beginning, it had more of a political bent to it, meaning the sticky wicket issues of Cyprus, the Kurdish issue, the Armenian issue. It seemed to focus, and that's what I found, to be so limiting, and why I began my op-ed writing, reading, and speaking, and that was, as I said, I consider myself an educator, an advocate, and facilitator, and that was to put the plea out there, if you will, to meet the Turk on his or her own ground, to like or dislike them on their own ground, and not what somebody else has perhaps said before. And that was the beginning, I'd say, of my career, if you will. Issues, I don't do paperwork, by the way. That's the domain of L.A. So I end up doing a lot of interference, a lot of resource, a tremendous amount of public speaking, meeting with people, talking, like Anastasia said, about women traveling to Turkey, what it is it's to be. And that's why, for me, this has been a grand adventure, a learning experience from the time of telling people what they could take to Turkey or not, when we were taking coffee beans, because Turkish coffee, you need coffee beans. 1980s, there were no coffee beans. There was Nescafe. And so Turkey has changed so much. And I'd say it was also dealing with people like Turgut Özal, being traveling with them, because all of that was a different form of education. And I'm also, if I can just digress a moment, about women. I'm not bragging on myself as such, but I happen to be the first non-Turkish woman to hold this diplomatic post worldwide. I think that says a lot for the Turks. So now what do? I do this kind of work. I talk about Turkey, travel, women, issues, the economy, the burgeoning economy. Will it implode, explode? And the political aspects of what's happening now, Turkey is in transition. Turkey is now looking at itself to say, we've been in this region for so long. It's time to stand up again and see where we can help. As Davutoğlu said, no problems in the hood. Well, I'm sorry, that's all fallen apart. And there's some real challenges. So those are the issues that I deal with. But a lot of it is with the public in guiding them, helping them overcome a lot of bureaucracy.
Thank you. All right, so I will turn to questions from the audience, and I'm going to begin with questions that many of I got the most questions about. And the number one issue is Turkey and Israel. Here's one question. Is Turkey's increasing expression of militancy toward Israel heartfelt or just out of fear of Muslim reprisals? Generally, does any of you want to talk about the rift? Okay.
This is a thorny issue, of course. You know that. And you think of the Mavi Marmara and that incident. I would always like to take every one of these questions and try to look to focus on the big picture. And the big picture, the Turks and the Israelis I should say, and also Muslims and Jews in the Ottoman Empire have done quite well together. In fact, if you don't have to go back that far to see that Istanbul was the place for Jews to come to from Spain. So there is a tradition of communication. It's I think the boat incident has been very painful to the Turks. They're a very proud people. They also are very militaristic. There's no question about it. And so is Israel. But I don't think either one of them can afford to let this thing go out of control. I don't think that's realistic. I don't think either one of them is that unaware of what we're headed for here. It's significant that the Turks are, well, I'll say it this way, and I don't want to be offensive to anyone who is here from Turkey, but Turks are often considered by other Muslims not to be real Muslims. I've heard that many times, and I don't want that to be offensive, but it's just what I've heard. Well, and it's part of this other issue, which is that the Turks are headed for a bigger picture. I think that they are headed for a democracy. I think they are headed for accommodation with Israel. I think they're not stupid enough to say, oh, let's join other people in the area and wipe Israel off the map. I don't think that's realistic. But we need to sit down and talk. It's the same issue that I have come to many times. You know, Bibi needs to sit down with Erdogan and have a cup of coffee. I mean, that may sound simplistic, but do it every 2 weeks or every month, and you find out that we, in fact, have a lot in common here. The Turks are a very proud people. I've been held for a full day at gunpoint in Cyprus by Turks, so I know the feeling of being on the other end of potential problems with my body, for example. But anyhow, I think this is repairable, and I think both sides need to get to work on it right away.
I'd like to add on to that. The rift with Israel actually began as Turkey was using its good offices several years ago to have a dialogue between Israel and Syria. And they were just at the point of bringing together representatives from both nations face to face when Gaza blew up. So it was the first frustration, disappointment, and anger on the part of the Turks. So that put a little kink into it. And then Mavi Marmara exacerbated it. But I think one of the good news, pieces of good news, when we talk about talking, media doesn't always pick up on what goes on behind closed doors. The current ambassador in Washington, D.C. right now, Namik Tan, this is his third tour. And he, from his first two tours to the United States, as part of the embassy then, in a lesser capacity, had established a very good working relationship with the Israelis. And as a matter of fact, subsequently was ambassador to Israel. And now he's in Washington, D.C. So he's in a pivotal position and does spend a lot of time going back and forth. So there's talking, counseling, advice being given by people who really know and have lived in each other's backyards. So I just wanted to add that to it.
I'd like to add one thing, if I may, and that is the flotilla incident, which Steve referred to a year and a half ago. Both sides have powerful stories to tell, the Israelis and the Turks. And I could make a good argument for either one, but think about one thing. How would the Turks feel if the Israelis had sent a boat full of troublemakers up to Turkey intent on breaking a Turkish blockade? That's, I think, a question to ponder. All right. Another common question is the status of EU membership. The application has been in for a long time, and people wonder whether it's a question of dislike of Muslims or fear of Muslims among Europeans or concern about the state of democracy. Any of you like to take that on?
I don't even know. I think that you know, even during the time that I was there, the bid was kept being pushed into the future, and then, you know, all of these other states were being accepted, and I think that there was a feeling of being snubbed, and I think that it coincided with Turkey turning to its eastern neighbors and starting to rehabilitate its relationships there. So I don't think that they're going to be turning back toward the West anytime soon. And I think that the people are not only they've been watching and aware of that, but just in the time that I was there, I saw many, many more tourists from the Arab world in the streets of Istanbul than I had seen when I first got there. So, I mean, it's been changing very slowly, just the face of even the streets there, like who are your friends and who are not your friends. And one of the reasons is because actually some of those tourists, because they felt so unwelcome in Europe, were then redoubling their interest in visiting Istanbul instead of Paris.
I think Turkey under Mustafa Kemal Atatürk made a conscious decision to look west. They still look west, but are recognizing, I think, as Joel said, Stephen said, the bigger picture, that they have the ability to expand in many directions. And whereas some years back, 94% of the population really thought their future would be in the European community, I don't believe that is there at all now. They see that there is a large world, the big picture, as we say. Mm-hmm. So consequently, and of course Europe's going through periods of being more abundant and having its own issues and problems right now. So the issue is not on the agenda, I don't think. They're going to pursue slowly. It's not dropping it. But it's not pressing, and the passion is not there the way it used to be. So for many of them, it's a non-issue right now.
If we have a little time, I'll just add a bit to that. There was a time, not too long ago, when it was an excitement on the part of many people in Turkey and many in Europe as well to join the EU. Actually, the EU is not doing very well these days, and so the Turks are saying, "Well, what do we need you for?" And that's an economic issue. Also, I've lived in Austria. I lived actually near the edge where the Ottoman Turks held Vienna in a siege twice. So the pain of that old story is very much alive in Austria, I can tell you. And it's a larger question, can essentially Christian nations really open their economy to a Muslim nation as the beginning, and then eventually to have a common military? I think that's an ideal, perhaps, down the road, but I don't think the world's ready for it now, and I don't think either side wants it. The Turks that I've talked to recently are not even interested, really, in the EU anymore.
Thank you. Here's another question we've received several of, and it's something actually I know about, so I'll maybe take a stab at it first. What is or should be Turkey's position in the Syrian crisis? Well, Turkey's position is actually quite admirable. Turkey early on condemned Assad. It has taken the position that he should lose power and has allowed hundreds, if not thousands, of deserting Syrian soldiers who are caught in the bind between either being shot for not firing on citizens or fleeing, have fled and set up camps in Turkey. And that's where the so-called Free Syrian Army is now headquartered. So I think Turkey's position in this particular controversy is quite admirable. Anybody else have a thought?
I'll just add a few thoughts there. We haven't really talked about the Kurds much, it has been mentioned, and it's a very powerful issue. The Kurds, by the way, linguistically are related to those of us who speak English. It's in the same family. And there is theoretically a Kurdistan. It's been a hope for centuries. Saladin himself was a Kurd. And so if you go back, and it's really not that long ago, the Third Crusade, you'll see that the Kurds were prominent. Why do I bring this up? Syria has also a large Kurdish population. Kurdistan includes the southwestern part of Turkey and Syria, and then part of Iran as well, other areas too. That's one issue, and that's a very thorny issue. On this other, the larger issue of Turkish Muslims in facing Arab Muslims in Syria, Bashar al-Assad in particular, I agree with Joel. I think that it's that Turkey is trying to chart a course there that makes sense, both for themselves and for the international community. It's very, very tough. We watch it unfold every day as we read the paper.
Similarly, how does Turkey relate to Iran? Well, I'll give a thumbnail there. They have said they don't approve of Iran creating nuclear weapons, but as Europe, Asia, and the West have imposed an oil embargo on Iran, Turkey has assertively said in the last week that it's going to continue buying oil from Iran, even though Saudi Arabia has ramped up production and offered its oil in substitution for Iran to almost anybody who wants to buy it. Anybody else have a thought?
I'll just say one thing, which is that I had dinner with Stephen Kinzer when he returned through Istanbul from his last trip, I think it was, to Iran. And right, he had just published a book about what's the name of it? Anyway, it was a book about the sort of Iran vis-a-vis Turkey.
It was Iran, U.S., and Turkey.
Yes. And, you know, one of the things that he was saying, which I can totally see as an archaeology major, is that, I mean, those are two historical powerhouses in the region that, regardless of all of these little things in between, actually, in the larger scheme of things, they're the most viable leaders of the region, and they're going to have to, one, either work it out or duke it out. But it's between those two, and really the other ones fall away.
I would concur with that in that Turkey and Iran have had very close relations. Then it's been strained. And then now, as Joel said, the Turkey believes in Iran's right to develop nuclear energy but not nuclear weapons. And I think the bottom line is the cooperation that there might have been. There's not room in the area, as Soner Çağatay said recently, there's not room in the region for a Shah and a Sultan. There's room for either one. And right now, the way he sees it, is that these are very interesting and challenging times for Iran and Turkey, as well as the region. Because Iran has suddenly indicated that it's willing perhaps to discuss and to talk about their relationship with the West. Turkey's been trying to be a modulating factor. And so I think we are in a period, as Anastasia said about Turkey, but a period of transition and limbo right now. And the question is, will it be a Shah or a Sultan, or will they somehow forego those titles?
Okay, very quickly. I'd just like to add a thought as it relates to the big picture and some ancient history as well. It's important to remember that Iran is 2,500 years old, and if it was a very distinguished cultural history. That is not true for, I mean, the Turks have a distinguished history as well, but it's not that old. And it's also important to remember in the big picture, if you look at Shia and Sunni, this is really has become extremely important recently. Iran is the only really large Shia country, Shia Islam. That tells you a lot about the separation of Persians from Arabs. I don't want to make too much of that separation, but it's part of the big picture. The Turks are Sunni, so they're tied in that regard to the Arab, most of the Arab nations. This is part of the backdrop, I think. If you look at the mullahs of Iran, you're looking at a continuation that is really part of Shia, a Shia development, the divine right of kings, which is not a Sunni concept. So anyhow, I just want to leave that with you as a thought. I think that there is a real separation there, but there's a lot that can be done. And I think the Turks should be trusted because they're really looking forward to their own future, and that includes their future with their neighbors as well.
Thank you. Well, we have run out of time. All of us, I think, recognize that Turkey is an extremely important country now, potentially a bridge between East and West. It has some problems, but so does every country. Its democracy is relatively young. But I think we need to follow Turkey closely because it is of growing influence in its region. And the United States should encourage the nation to respect and encourage plurality of voices in its national debates. Our thanks to our distinguished panelists, Bonnie, Stephen, and Anastasia. We also thank our audiences here as well as those on the radio. And now the meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, over 108 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.